and the promoter's expenses are $150,000, there's $100,000 in net profits. $250,000 income less $150,000 expenses. In a 90-10 deal, 90% of this, or $90,000, goes to the artist. If the artist got a $60,000 guarantee, that's deducted from the artist's share, so the artist gets an additional $30,000. The $90,000 share of profits less the $60,000 guarantee. Here's a cheat sheet. Gross ticket sales, $250,000, less promoter expenses of $150,000 equals net profits, $100,000, times 90% equals the artist's share, $90,000, less the guarantee, $60,000, equals payable on night of show, $30,000. The sensitivity of profits to ticket pricing, which we covered in the previous section for mid-level artists, is even more dramatic when you get to the superstar level. As we discussed, once you've covered expenses, almost all of the price increase goes directly into your pocket. And stars who attract older audiences normally charge in the range of $75 to $175 per ticket, with some superstars charging as high as $400 per ticket, occasionally even more, which means these artists can walk away with truckloads of money. We previously discussed charging higher prices for better seats, but now let's take a deeper dive into it. There are normally two, but sometimes up to four, levels of pricing at each concert, from P1, meaning price one, the most expensive, down to P4 in the nosebleed section. The gray areas between these sections, for example, the last row of P1 and the first row of P2, are called flex, and there's a new trend in ticketing called flexing the house, which means you vary the ticket prices based on demand. For example, if the front orchestra is selling well, the promoter may expand P1 pricing to include more of the middle/back orchestra. If demand dies down, those seats drop to a P2 price. Also, as we discussed earlier in this chapter, some artists put their tickets through a platinum ticketing platform, which is another way to price tickets based on demand. Computation of net profits. Let's look at some of the finer points in computing net profits. Net profits are defined as gross receipts less the promoter's expenses. The calculation looks like this. Gross receipts. Gross receipts means gross monies from ticket sales less selling costs, such as ticket fees, credit card charges, taxes, and facilities charges. That's pretty straightforward, but your team should go to great lengths to make sure you get an accurate accounting. For example, some of my clients have their tour accountant count the house, meaning they actually count the number of seats and people in them, and or, especially in dates where there are no seats, stand at the door with clickers and count the number of people who come in response to which one promoter opened three other entrance doors without telling us. Also included in gross receipts are the monies from VIP ticketing, which I'll talk about in the next section. Sometimes sponsorship money is also included, which is discussed in the section after VIP ticketing. Expenses. From the gross, the promoter deducts every expense he or she can possibly think of. The major ones are 1. Advertising. It's obvious when you think about it, but not until then, that the more important an artist you are, the less advertising money the promoter has to spend. One or two announcements of a major show usually does it, so watch this expense. On the other hand, major stars don't want the promoter to underspend. That sounds weird at first. In a profits deal, 85% to 90% of the advertising is charged to you. But the reason is that advertising can be a cross-promotion for a current record, and it also helps make sure your tour is perceived as an event. Some of the larger promoters own their own advertising agencies, and the ad agency charges 15% on top of the advertising monies paid to internet sites, radio stations, etc. For example, if the promoter spends $10,000 on radio ads, their ad agency would charge an extra $1,500, 15%, for a total of $11,500 in computing your profits. The promoters argue that if they used an unaffiliated advertising agency, they'd have to pay this 15%, which is true. So why should you get a break? You say that the promoter owns this agency, so the money is only moving from one of the promoter's pockets to another. If you have enough clout, most or all of the 15% disappears. 2. Rent for the facility. 3. Personnel, box office, cleanup, ushers, ticket takers, doormen, etc. 4. Rental of equipment, PA, public address system, lights, pianos, etc. 5. Insurance. 6. Security. 7. Stage crew. 8. Ground transportation for the artist and entourage. 9. Catering for artist and crew. 10. Public performance license for the music. Refer back to the public performance royalty section in Chapter 16 for what this is. 11. Medical. 12. Elvis impersonators. Just seeing if you're paying attention. Over the years, as promoters' profit margins got more and more squeezed, they developed systematic ways of adding to the expenses. Crasser promoters have been known simply to create phony invoices for various items. A more sophisticated example is where the promoter advertises so much on the local radio station that they get a rebate at the end of the year. In other words, if they spend $100,000 for ads on a radio station, the station gives them back $5,000 at year-end. This doesn't show up on each individual invoice, and thus the shows are charged for the full amount. Another example is a rebate that promoters get from Ticketmaster and certain venues, which they also don't share. The interesting part is that everyone knows what the promoters are doing, and so there is this little waltz of the toreadors while your agent negotiates how much the promoter can steal from you, using much more civilized terms, of course. Because everyone knows what expenses really are, there are accepted amounts of stealing, and it's bad form for A, the promoter to steal more than is customary, or B, the artist to catch the promoter and not allow the accepted level. So in this bizarre Netherland, everyone reaches a happy compromise. Promoter profit deals. In a promoter profit deal, a promoter's profit is added as an expense, which has the effect of delaying your split of proceeds until the promoter gets a negotiated amount of money. This is easier to understand using numbers. For example, if the gross from a particular show is $100,000 and the expenses are $60,000, the net profits would be $40,000, $100,000 minus $60,000. If your deal is 90-10, you would get 90% of $40,000, or $36,000. However, if the promoter's deal allows them to add a profit of $10,000 as an expense, the net profits would only be $30,000, because the expenses are now $70,000. The $60,000 actual expenses plus the promoter's $10,000 profit. Thus, you would get only 90% of $30,000, or $27,000, instead of $36,000. In other words, you got $9,000 less because you're paying 90% of the $10,000 profit. Deals that add a promoter profit are also called split point deals. That's because adding their profit raises the point at which you split the net. Using the given example, if there were no promoter profit, you would split the monies after $60,000 of gross income, when the gross equals the expenses. In a split point deal, you wouldn't start sharing until the gross equals $70,000, expenses plus a $10,000 promoter profit. So $70,000 becomes the split point. As your bargaining power increases, the promoter's ability to add a profit disappears. Splits based on gross. Some superstar acts get a percentage of gross income. In these deals, the expenses are, of course, irrelevant. The range is 65% to 70% of gross, and the artist can get even more when the ticket prices are high. Remember, the expenses are fixed, so that as gross income, i.e., the ticket price, goes up, expenses become a smaller percentage of the gross, which means the artist can get a bigger piece of it. For example, if the expenses were $50,000 and the gross was $100,000, the expenses are 50% of the gross. But if the gross was $200,000, the $50,000 expenses would only be 25%. So the higher the ticket price, the bigger the artist's share of gross. Actually, these deals are not based strictly on gross, but on something bizarrely called net gross. Net gross means the promoter's gross income, less surcharges, amounts the building adds to the ticket price and keeps for itself, ticket fees, credit card fees, parking, if parking is part of the ticket price, and taxes. VIP ticketing. Another profit center for big tours is VIP ticketing. These are P1 tickets, the most expensive tickets, packaged with a value bonus. The bonus can range from a basket of goodies, signed photo, signed poster, special t-shirt not otherwise available, custom spatulas, etc., to a special area in the venue with drinks and maybe food, up to a meet and greet with the artist before or after the show. Some VIP packages let you into the venue early to watch a sound check, essentially a rehearsal where the artist does a few songs on stage to make sure the sound is right in the arena, sometimes followed by a question and answer session with the artist from the stage. If you're doing a national tour with one promoter, more about that later in this chapter, VIP ticketing is usually built into the overall deal. If not, there are companies that specialize in VIP ticketing, including some merchandising companies, who will handle this for you. These folks put together the packages, sell the tickets, make arrangements with the venues, manage the fans when they get there, etc. The VIP ticketing companies charge 10% to 25% for this, which includes all the costs, the merchandise, customer service fees, building rentals, etc. Sponsorship. Major tours can do deals with sponsors, who pay money to be associated with the tour as a marketing move. The terms of the deals vary massively, depending on your stature, the length of the tour, and the rights you're giving the sponsor. For example, is it just a tour sponsorship, or are you also doing a commercial? Are they the only sponsor? If not, are they the main sponsor, or are they an also presents? I've seen deals from as little as $10,000 for a baby band to well into seven figures for major stars. I know that's not particularly helpful, but it's a little like trying to answer the question, how much is a car? The major deal sponsorship points are 1. How many dates are they sponsoring? 2. In what territories? 3. What is the exclusivity? For example, if your sponsor is a soft drink, what products do you have to avoid endorsing besides soft drinks? It's almost always bottled water and flavored waters, but it could be liquor. And sometimes the soft drink company owns other companies that make random things like computers, so they don't want you endorsing those either. 4. Are you doing a commercial? If so, in what media and in what territories? and how long can they run it? 5. Can they use your music in their ads? If so, who's paying the record company and publisher for the rights? 6. Do they get free tickets? Free tickets actually cost you money on a hot tour, because you won't get the price of the tickets from a fan. Whether or not the sponsor gets freebies, they will want the right to buy tickets before the public gets them. If you agree to that, how many tickets do they get, and in what sections? 7. Will you do a meet and greet with the sponsor's guests? If so, how many guests, how many shows, and in which markets? 8. How will the sponsor's name be positioned on tickets and in tour ads? 9. How will the sponsor's banners be positioned in the venues? I'm only scratching the surface here, because these deals get pretty complex, but you get the idea. Hall fees. Over the last few years, agents have become responsible for negotiating hall fees. A hall fee is the amount charged by the building for selling merchandise, t-shirts, posters, etc., and it's a percentage of the gross sales. We'll hit this in detail in the next chapter, so hang loose till then. Riders. The actual contracts for each appearance are customarily handled by the agency. At lower levels, they're merely AFM printed forms, though most agents have standard forms they attach to this. As you hit mid-level to superstar, they're the same printed forms with an attached rider, an addendum that rides on top of another contract. Your attorney, together with your manager and agent, puts the rider together for you, and it's the guts of the deal. The contract itself is only one or two pages, listing the specific terms, dates, guarantee, hall size, splits, etc. Riders can run 30 pages or more. Here are the major points covered in your rider. Expenses. If your deal involves a split of profits, the promoter's expenses should be listed separately, with maximum amounts for each category. Sometimes this list is in the contract itself. In other words, the rider says you can only be charged for the actual expense, or the maximum in the contract, whichever is less. The rider should also spell out your right to verify expenses by auditing invoices, checks, etc. Free tickets. You should get a certain number of free tickets for yourself, called comps, an abbreviation of complimentary, to each performance, usually 50 to 100, though that varies with the size of the venues. You also want to limit the number of free tickets that the promoter can give away without your consent, usually 25 or so. Also, as earlier noted, if you have a tour sponsor, you may have to give and/or sell tickets to them, and the rider covers this as well. Keep this in mind with respect to freebies. If you had put these tickets on sale, 85% to 90% of the money from those sales would have been yours, so go easy on the comps. Free tickets are usually a minimal item and not a big deal. However, some artists may not do so well in certain cities, so the promoter might give away as many tickets as humanly possible to make the house look full. This is called papering the house, and it's done very quietly. If you find a lot of police officers, firefighters, city councilors, and similar folks boogieing and/or holding their ears in your audience, there's a good chance you've been papered. I use an interesting clause that says the promoter's free tickets can't be in the first 10 rows. Can you guess why? The answer is near the end of this chapter. Billing. Billing means the way your name is listed, how you will be billed, in ads, publicity, billboards, tickets, the venue marquee, and anywhere else that credits show up. You, of course, want 100% headline billing, and you should have the right to approve the presence and size of anybody else's name along with yours. Recording. The rider should have strict prohibitions against the promoter recording your performance in any way, whether audio and or visual. A poor quality, or even worse, a good quality, bootleg recording is a serious ripoff of your professional life, not to mention a possible violation of your record deal. I put in extraordinarily tough language, including high damages for a violation. With the advent of smartphones, however, it's impossible to keep audience members from photographing or recording shows, unless you hire stormtroopers to goose-step through the auditorium. However, you should print on your tickets that they can't use professional equipment or commercially exploit what they record. Merchandising. Your merchandiser will require you to include specific language giving them the exclusive right to sell merchandise at your concert. Merchandising is discussed in Chapter 24. Interviews/promos. Be sure the promoter can't commit you to any interviews or local promotions or sponsors without your consent. Catering. I have so much fun reading the catering requirements of riders that I've made it a hobby. Many riders have three or more pages listing food and drink that the promoter has to provide for the artist and the crew. They range from mundane foods for the crew to true exotica for the headliner. I always get a kick out of artists who require organic, GMO-free antioxidants, together with six cases of beer. Here are some of the better items, actually lifted from various riders over the years. Turkey, white meat only, never rolled or pressed. Gourmet-grade coffee, no canteen type. Lactaid non-fat milk. Shelled red pistachios. M&Ms, with the brown ones removed. Technical. You need to have very specific technical specifications for your show, such as the size of stage, what equipment the promoter has to supply, power requirements, security needs, dressing room facilities, sound check, meaning the time you can come into the actual venue and set the levels of your sound equipment, etc. Sometimes this is in a separate tech rider. Legal. Riders have a lot of legal sections regarding cancellation, bad weather, riots, mechanics of payment, insurance, lawyer jokes, etc. I'll take the whole thing. Many artists sell their entire tour to a single promoter. These deals look very similar to single-night deals, except, of course, they cover all the dates. The major economic difference is that all the dates are cross-collateralized. We discussed this concept in record deals back at the end of Chapter 8. For tours, it means the promoter gets back their losses on turkeys from successful shows. This, of course, isn't good for you as an artist. Without cross-collateralization, you'd get paid on the good dates, and the promoters would eat the bad ones. On the other hand, you can usually get a larger overall guarantee in these deals because the promoter is hedging their risk. Sometimes you can get a limited cross-collateralization. For example, the six major market dates might be crossed with each other. The eight secondary market dates are crossed with each other, etc. These deals are easier logistically because you only have to deal with one promoter, and you only have to do one contract for the entire tour, as opposed to separate negotiations for each date. But since you're dealing with a huge promoter and gargantuans tend to flex their muscles, they can push back harder than individual promoters. As discussed earlier in this chapter, when you're doing one of these deals, the issue of VIP ticketing comes up. The national promoter wants these rights as part of the package, and their guarantee is priced higher because it includes VIP package income as well as straight concert revenue. The major promoters have divisions that do VIP ticketing, who, of course, they want to use. If the promoter allows you to use an independent VIP ticketing company, it will want the income put into gross, which means they can use it to recoup their guarantee. You can sometimes make a deal to keep all the VIP income yourself, but it'll mean less of a guarantee. The national promoters also want to share in any tour sponsorship income. Their argument is that it's an element of the tour, and therefore the money should go in the pot. But this is negotiable. Some deals include sponsorship if the promoter finds the sponsor, for which they'll want a 20% fee off the top before putting the money into gross. With enough clout, and if their advance offer wasn't based on getting sponsorship money, you can keep at least a portion of the sponsorship income outside the pot. If the sponsorship deal includes a commercial endorsing their product that doesn't mention the tour, you should keep all of that money yourself. There's some controversy over what these one promoter tour deals mean for the agents. Some people argue that since you only have to make one deal instead of the usual multiple deals for a tour with different promoters, maybe you don't need an agent. On the other hand, someone needs to supervise the national promoter, and agents have a lot of experience working with them. For example, you need to make sure the promoter is properly marketing your tour, that you're getting an honest ticket count, that the promoter is making the best deals with the venues. In fact, some of these promoters own the venues, so you have to be especially careful how they deal with themselves, etc. So arguably, these big promoters need even more supervision. You're dealing with one powerful source rather than a number of smaller players. Good, bad, or ugly, these deals are becoming the norm for major acts. However, when the promoters consolidated into big chunks, more little seedlings began winding their way through the cracks. In other words, alternatives to the big players are starting to grow up as real forces in the marketplace. Specifically, these are the invisible venues we discussed earlier in this chapter, meaning fairs, casinos, and performing arts centers. Multi-show deals. A new creature that's developed over the last few years is the idea of making multi-show deals that aren't tied to specific gigs. Under these contracts, you agree to perform a set number of shows, but the dates and locations are worked out in the future. For example, a promoter signs you up for 50 shows over the course of the next year or two, at times and places to be mutually agreed. Generally, these deals pay up to half the money when you sign, and sometimes you can also get non-recoupable money as a bonus. Multi-show deals are exclusive, meaning you can't perform live for anyone else during the term of the deal. Because of this, they're very close in concept to a record deal, where only one company has the rights to your services. However, there are some things you can usually carve out of the exclusivity. At a minimum, you should have the right to do non-public gigs for corporations in connection with a sponsorship deal, for some rich dude's wedding, etc., as well as charity concerts, radio concerts, refer back to Chapter 13, and TV appearances. So how did these multi-show deals come about, and why would you want one? From the promoter's point of view, they want to tie you up because they're betting you'll get hotter. If they're right, they not only get a bargain price for your shows, but they also keep you from playing for their competitors. It's not a coincidence that the biggest players in the multi-show game are Live Nation and AEG, who both control venues they need to keep filled. From your point of view, you can get substantial guaranteed money, multi-millions if you're really hot, and you can get a good chunk of the dough up front. So if you need or just want a big check, these are the deals for you. In addition, the promoters say that they'll put more juice behind you if you're exclusively tied to them. For example, they'll market you in all the venues they control, push you on their ticketing sites, etc. Multi-show deals come in two flavors, guarantee deals and earnouts. A guarantee deal means there's an amount of money guaranteed for a set number of concerts. This is exactly like the deals we just described for a specific tour, except that it doesn't specify which shows you'll be playing. For example, you might get a $1 million guarantee for 20 shows on mutually agreed dates over the next year, meaning $50,000 per night. Of that money, you might get $500,000 on signing and the balance as the shows are played. Note that you'll have expenses when you play these shows: travel, sound, lights, band, hotels, etc. So you want to make sure there's enough money left to cover each date's expenses, ideally with some profit on top. Otherwise, if you've gotten your entire profit up front, you'll be on the road making zero, or writing a check to cover expenses, which means you won't be so anxious to head out. You're probably thinking, hey, no sweat, I'll just do 20 dates, and if the promoter bets wrong and loses money, too bad. Well, that's mostly true under a guaranteed deal. I say mostly because it's not always the case. If the promoter hasn't earned back the guarantee at the end of 20 shows, they want the right to tack on more dates. The norm is 10% to 20% of the total dates, meaning 2 to 4 additional dates in our 20-show example. You, of course, don't get paid for those because you're still paying off your guarantee. But after those shows, even if you're still in the hole, you can walk. Because the promoter is risking that you might walk out and leave them with a loss, guarantee deals are not easy to come by. And for the same reason, if you can do a guarantee deal, it will pay you less money than an earnout deal. Speaking of earnouts, the far more common multi-show deal is an earnout, which means the term of the deal continues until you earn back the money, regardless of the number of shows. Using our example of $1 million over 20 dates, in an earnout deal, the 20 shows are really just a minimum. The term of the deal is extended until you've played enough dates for the promoter to get back their money. And if your career does a belly flop, that could be a long time, during which you might be working for zero because you've already gotten all the dough. The lesson is that in an earnout deal, always try for a right to end the deal by repaying the unrecouped money. If the promoter agrees, you'll only have this right after you've played the minimum number of shows, to keep you from walking out early if you get incredibly hot halfway through the deal. For example, if you play 20 shows and earn back only $900,000 of the $1 million, you could pay them $100,000 and be done. You won't likely have the money to write a check, but your next promoter could. Or more commonly, when you get near the end of the deal, you renegotiate with your promoter to extend the term and get more money, which furthers the promoter's original goal of keeping you in their orbit. Lining your pockets with more gold. And now to my promised method of making you more money. Let me first say a couple of words about money in general. More income versus cutting expenses. It's more expensive to put another dollar of income in your pocket than it is to put a dollar of cost savings in your pocket. This may sound a bit weird, so let me explain. For every dollar of income you make, you have to pay your manager, agent, and perhaps business manager and/or lawyer, if they're on a percentage, out of it. This will leave, for example, only about 65 cents to 75 cents to go into your pocket. On the other hand, for every dollar of expense you save, the whole dollar goes in your pocket, because you've already paid the professionals on the money that would have been used to pay the expense. Of course, if your professionals are paid a percentage of your net income instead of your gross, it doesn't save money. But I still want you to cut costs for your and their sakes. Let's look at an example. Suppose your tour grosses $1 million and your professional team's fees total 35%, $350,000. This means that you have $650,000 after commissions, out of which you have to pay $400,000 in expenses. Thus, your net, after everything, is $250,000. I'm ignoring income taxes. Had you earned another $100,000 on the tour, 35% would have gone off the top to your professional team, leaving you $65,000. Since your expenses are already covered, the full $65,000 would be in your pocket. Thus, your net after everything is $315,000, $250,000 plus the $65,000. On the other hand, if you didn't earn another $100,000, but instead saved $100,000 in expenses, the picture looks quite different. Instead of deducting $400,000 in expenses, you'd deduct only $300,000, and your net after everything would be $350,000. You thus keep the full $100,000 by cutting expenses, which is almost 60% more than the $65,000 you would put in your pocket by earning another $100,000. Look at the chart in the accompanying PDF. If you add another zero or two to these numbers, they get even more impressive. What to do? How do you pull off this minor miracle? It's pretty simple, but you may not like the answer. Spend less. Here are the biggest areas of abuse. Salaries. Watch carefully how much you're paying your band and crew, and really think about how many of them you need. This is primarily your manager or tour manager's area of expertise, and you obviously don't want to scrimp on essential personnel. But you don't always need to carry as many people as you think, or to pay them as much as they demand. And it's not just salaries. For every extra person, it's also hotels, transportation, food, etc. Be extra careful with friends and relatives. Hiring pals with little or nothing to do is not only wasteful, it's demoralizing to the people who really work. And you have the added expenses for hotels, food, etc. Stage, sound, and lights. Your stage, sound, and lighting systems have to be up to your level. Anything less cheats your audience. On the other hand, these expenses can eat up a large chunk of your profits. And the costs aren't just the obvious ones of building fancier sets. Larger staging also means you need to hire more trucks to haul the stuff around, hire more folks to drive those trucks, and hire more crew to load it, unload it, set it up, and tear it down. Not to mention transporting, housing, and feeding those extra mouths. So plan your staging smartly. Remember, your fans are there to see you perform. And if you need an array of animals and rocket ships to keep their attention, either something is wrong with your show or you're being insecure and hiding behind the hoopla. You're better than that. You wouldn't be where you are if you weren't. Of course, you should always do something innovative and spectacular, but be practical as well. Startup costs. It's expensive to get ready for a big tour. There are equipment costs, like building a stage, designing and renting sound systems, lighting rigs, and video screens. All of these together are called the tour's production, meaning what it takes to put on, produce the show. On top of production, you have the cost of rehearsing the band and dancers, which means paying and housing them, and some crew, for a number of weeks, as well as renting halls to rehearse in. You can save a good amount of money by rehearsing the band and dancers in a small venue, then waiting until just before the tour to move into a big hall with the full stage, sound, lights, and videos. Travel. You can save a lot by traveling light. This means two things. One, almost nothing I know of, except non-income producing real estate and owning a restaurant, eats money like chartering or, heaven forbid, owning your own jet. When you reach a certain level, particularly if you're a paparazzi magnet, it makes economic sense, or at least not a significant difference, to begin chartering planes. But for the most part, flying commercial is feasible and substantially less expensive. I know it's more inconvenient, the hassles of the public in the airport and on the plane, delayed flights, missing planes, etc. But every major celebrity and political figure has at one time or another flown commercial, and all survived the experience. Remember, it's your money. 2. Try not to hub. Hubbing means you base yourself in a central location, say, Dallas-Fort Worth, while you play venues within a short flight from that city, other parts of Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas. When you stay in one place like this, you double your mileage. Every day, you not only fly to the gig, but you have to fly back. And most artists like to hub out of expensive cities, which increases your hotel/lodging bills. Catering. Some artists are particularly notorious for having lavish spreads backstage, much of which is never eaten by them or even touched by human hands. Or worse yet, it's eaten by the hangers-on who show up to see what they can scam. I said that to make you mad, but it's true. Because these goodies are supplied by the promoter as part of your deal, it feels like the promoter is paying for them. But in truth, 90% of this expense is yours. Remember, as you get into the major leagues, you make only a portion of your money from the guarantee. A nice chunk of it comes from the profit split, which is usually 90-10. Refer back to the Superstar Touring section earlier in this chapter for a description of profit splits. Thus, every dollar spent on food for scavengers is 90 cents less you put in your pocket. So ditch the imported caviar and order in from Burger King. Just watch it. The given examples aren't exhaustive. There are many other ways to cut expenses. And I'm always surprised that people find even more innovative ways to spend money. I know the road is a hassle, and you want to be comfortable. There's nothing wrong with that. But be mindful of your expenses and keep them down. You'll be glad you did when you get home and count your take. Answer to the question earlier in this chapter. I use an interesting clause that says the promoter's free tickets can't be in the first 10 rows. Can you guess why? Answer. Nothing is as much fun as playing your heart out to a standing, screaming audience, only to have a bunch of coat and tie zombies sitting in the first 10 rows looking at their smartphones. Part 6. Merchandising. Chapter 24. Tour Merchandising. So now you're famous, and kids can't wait to plaster your face and logo on their backs, fronts, caps, bedroom walls, etc. And bootleggers can't wait to rip you off by illegally making your merchandise. More about bootleggers later. Selling products, t-shirts, posters, hoodies, hats, etc., that use your name, logo, or likeness is called merchandising, also called merch. As the world swings to streaming, merch is taking on an interesting importance. With CD sales drying up like a Serengeti waterhole, if your fans want something tangible with your vibes in it, they're limited to vinyl, a new technology to youngsters, and merchandise. Since most people don't wear vinyl albums, merch is one of the few ways they can impress their friends by showing they're a fan of yours. And apart from the money, every t-shirt is a walking billboard for you. There are three flavors of merch rights. 1. Tour merchandising. This is the stuff sold at concert venues for prices you'd never pay anywhere else, so you can prove you were there. 2. Retail merchandising. This is basically the same stuff, without tour names or dates, but it's sold at the mall or in other brick-and-mortar stores and through those retailers' websites. 3. D2C, meaning direct-to-consumer, which is also called e-commerce or internet sales. These are online sales through your web store, and they're also called direct sales because you deliver the goods directly into the consumer's hands rather than going through a retail store. Merchandisers will also run your fan club if you want one. More about that in the next chapter, in the section titled Fan Clubs. Of the three categories, tour merchandise is by far the more significant moneymaker, assuming, of course, that you're touring. Otherwise, it doesn't mean much. While retail and D2C merchandising may be more visible, they don't create the same sales frenzy as concerts do. For the obvious reasons. People are all pumped up by the show. They want a souvenir. They want to wear something that lets their friends know, I was at the show and you weren't, etc. So let's discuss tour merchandising first. Then we'll deal with retail and D2C in the next chapter. Tour merchandisers. Tour merch can be a good source of dough. In the beginning, you can handle it yourself by printing some t-shirts and selling them at your shows. However, as you start to sell more tickets and get to bigger clubs, it takes a lot more effort to handle the sales. For example, you'll need A. more space to carry the stuff around, B. someone without sticky fingers to do the selling and keeping track of it, and C. a lot of administrative help, such as paying sales taxes, dealing with border crossings and customs issues, etc. At that point, it makes sense to get a merchandising company to take care of all this. When you make a merch deal, you license the right to use your name and likeness to someone cleverly called a merchandiser. A merchandiser, very much like a record company, manufactures the goods, oversees the sales at your concerts, and pays you for each sale. Royalties. Most tour merchandising royalties are based on sharing the net profits from your merch sales, though it's sometimes possible, at the superstar level, to get a royalty based on the gross sales price of some items. More about that in a minute. The computation of net profits is pretty much what it sounds like. The merchandiser throws the gross selling price of all your merch into a pot, then deducts the cost of manufacturing, credit card fees, freight, sales taxes, VAT, hall fees, more about VAT and hall fees in a minute, etc. The range of artist royalties for touring merchandise in the United States and Canada is about 75% to 80% of profits, and there are higher splits for superstars. It's not uncommon to escalate your royalties based on sales, which can either be on a per-night basis or a cumulative basis for the entire tour. In the superstar world, you can sometimes get a royalty based on gross sales as opposed to the net, which means the merchandiser doesn't deduct the costs. Well, actually, they deduct a few, which we'll discuss in just a minute. But this kind of deal is getting harder and harder to come by. Of course, a royalty based on gross sales will be lower than a royalty computed on net profits, because the base is so much higher. The range is 30% to 40% for the United States, and Canada is often a few percentage points less. The gross sales to which your royalty percentage applies is a term of art. It means the selling price to the public, less only taxes, sales tax, value-added tax, excise and similar taxes, and credit card fees. Value-added tax, or VAT to its pals, is something we don't have yet in the United States, but it's common in other countries. VAT is a tax on goods at each stage of creation, based on the value added at that point. For example, there's a tax on the lumber mill as it cuts down a tree and turns it into lumber, adding value. A tax on the furniture manufacturer when it turns the lumber into furniture, more value added. A tax when the upholsterer does its thing, etc. The tax gets bigger at each stage, but through a system of crediting back, which I have never needed to fully understand, so I don't, each guy gets a credit for the tax paid by the previous guy, but it pumps up the price to the consumer. If you do get a deal based on gross sales, which as I said is rarer and rarer, the merchandiser will not want to pay a gross royalty on tour programs or specialty items, meaning expensive items. That's because the cost of creating those goods is so high that they can't afford to fork over a big piece of the gross price. For example, tour programs require someone to create the artwork, write the text, clear the rights to the photos, and print them up. Also, major artists sometimes have designer goods, such as a custom-made $100-plus sweatshirt or a $500-plus leather jacket. Because a designer is paid a fee or royalty on these goods, your royalty is lower, usually around 75% of net profits. Hall fees. As artists pushed royalties higher, the merchandisers started building limits on hall fees into their contracts. What's a hall fee? Your merchandiser doesn't usually hire people to sell products in each of the venues. Instead, they make a deal with the hall, meaning the building where you're playing, to supply the personnel, display racks, etc. It works like this. The merchandiser pulls up its truck early on the day of the show, checks in a certain quantity of merchandise to the hall personnel, and at the end of the evening, gets back the remaining merchandise plus payment for what's been sold or otherwise disappeared. From the money that's turned over, the venue keeps a percentage, and this is the hall fee. It covers the cost of hiring the people to actually sell the crap, plus the venue's profit. Hall fees often include a charge, usually 1% of gross, for bootleg security. More about that in a minute. By the way, not all venues actually supply the merchandise personnel themselves. There are a couple of companies that contract with venues to supply the vendors. In that case, the independent company gets a percentage of the hall fee from the venue. Your agent negotiates the hall fee percentage with the venue, though your merchandiser may help. A standard hall fee is from 25% to 30% of the gross monies collected for the merchandise, minus tax, and superstars can sometimes knock it down even lower. So if you sold $10,000 of merchandise after deducting taxes, the hall would keep 25% to 30%, $2,500 to $3,000, and pay the balance to the merchandiser. These are U.S. numbers. You can sometimes get lower fees, around 18% to 20%, in foreign markets. You can also negotiate a lower fee, 10%, for non-apparel items like CDs, vinyl, or program sales. If you go over the hall fee limit, the excess comes out of your royalties. For example, a merchandise deal might say that you have a royalty of 80% of profits and that the hall fee can't exceed 30%. Under this deal, if your hall fee for a particular date was 35%, i.e., 5% more than the allowed 30%, the extra 5% would come out of your royalty. Note, this doesn't mean you go from 80% of profits to 75% of profits. It means you get 80% of profits less 5% of gross sales. That 5% of gross is much bigger than 5% of net, so you're getting less than 75% of profits. In other words, this is a big deal point. It's to your advantage to push the hall fee down in your deals with the venues, because you get most of the savings. In the given example, if you get a hall fee down to 25%, i.e., you saved 5% below the 30% maximum, that 5% savings reduces expenses. So if your deal is that you get 80% of net profits, 80% of those savings slide over to your side of the table. The buildings like to stick a 5% credit card fee on top of the hall fee. In a net profit deal, this is one more expense that comes out before you split. In a royalty deal, the merchandiser will charge the full 5% against your royalties. Because you're paying most or all of this fee, try to get the building to lower it to the amount actually charged by the credit card company, which is less than 5%. That's not always easy to get. Hall fees are negotiated by the artist's agent at the same time they make the overall deal for the guarantee, splits, etc. Ironically, the agent doesn't get paid for this. The agent's commission is based on the artist's earnings from the performance only, and not from merchandising. So the agent is in the position of negotiating a part of the deal that gives him or her no benefit. However, their incentive goes way up when the artist glares daggers at them, so they've gotten quite good at muscling down the hall percentages. Advances. As you learn from record and publishing deals, where there are royalties, there are advances, and merchandising is just such a place. Unfortunately, they're not nearly as favorable as record and publishing advances because they're almost always returnable. In other words, unlike the non-returnable advances you get from record companies and publishers, which you keep whether earned or not, you might have to pay back some or all of the merch advance. We'll get into payback mechanics in a minute. Also, you might have to pay them interest on top of the advance, meaning you'd pay back more than you got. In other words, merchandising advances are very much like loans. Tour merchandising advances are usually paid over the course of a tour. For example, if your merchandising advance is $100,000, you might get $50,000 when you sign the deal, $25,000 a third of the way through the tour, and the balance when you've done two-thirds of the dates. As your bargaining power goes up, you can get more of the advance sooner. A lot of artists use their merch advance to pay for the startup costs of a tour. Startup costs are the monies you buzz through before you go on the road, for example, to buy equipment, rent a rehearsal hall, hire your crew, build a set, put together sound and lights, hire dancers, jugglers, and mimes, etc. The size of the advance is based on a projection of your merch profits times your royalty rate. It'll therefore be bigger for larger tours. The more bodies you play for, the more merchandise you can sell. Advances will also be higher if the deal includes retail and D2C merchandising, which we'll discuss in the next chapter. Because they are so deal-specific, it's hard to give you any hard and fast numbers. The broad range is anywhere from nothing to $25,000 or $50,000 for a developing act to several million for a superstar. Because the advances are returnable, and because the term gets extended if you don't earn it back, as we'll discuss in our next topic, a number of artists opt to get a better royalty rate and take less of an advance, or no advance at all. This is particularly true for bigger artists who don't need the money. If you're with a good merch company, you can often make a lot more money this way. Term. The term of most merchandising agreements is 18 to 24 months, though it's occasionally longer if you're going on a massive tour. However, if the advance isn't recouped after that time, the term is automatically extended until the date of recoupment, which means the deal could go on forever if your career crashes or if you stop touring because you're disabled or bored. When you're negotiating a tour merch deal, try to get the right to repay the advance and terminate the deal during these extensions. That keeps you from having a perpetual merchandiser. For example, if you have a two-year deal with an extension until recoupment, and at the end of 2 years you've recouped all but $10,000 of a $500,000 advance, it means you've done pretty well. However, if you don't have the right to repay, the term would continue until you recoup. Thus, the merchandiser could automatically get your next tour for no advance. If you have the right to repay, however, you can write them a check for $10,000, which should be more than covered by the advance you'll get for your next tour, and move on. Or more commonly, you rattle your saber by threatening to repay the advance, which brings the merchandiser to the negotiating table and gets them to give you an additional advance to make a new deal. This payback right can only be good for you. If the unrecouped amount is really big, it means something is seriously wrong, and you won't leave because no one else wants you. If it's a small amount, you want the ability to pay them off or renegotiate the deal for the next tour. For this very reason, this provision is also getting harder to come by. Advance repayment. As just noted, unlike record and publishing deals, tour merchandise contracts require repayment of the advance, generally with interest. This is triggered by things like 1. The tour doesn't start on time. 2. You're disabled or otherwise unable to perform all or part of the tour. This is based on the same theory as the tour not starting on time, and also protects them from the possibility that you might not tour for years, after which the public has forgotten you exist. 3. You don't play an agreed number of dates. The merchandiser bases their advance on a forecast of the number of concerts and the size of the venues. If you decide to chuck the stadiums and play clubs, they won't be happy. Or if you cancel dates because tickets aren't selling, they won't be much happier. Of course, neither will you. 4. If the advance isn't recouped at the end of the agreed term, for example, 12 to 18 months, the company can demand repayment instead of just extending the term. As a practical matter, if you don't have the money, they can't really get it, but they'll grumble. And if you do have the money, they can get quite serious about wanting it back. When you negotiate these provisions, make sure you don't have to pay back more than the unrecouped balance. A lot of deals talk about paying back the advance, which could mean the total amount paid, regardless of what's recouped. So be sure your deal isn't one of those. Exclusivity. Tour merchandise deals are, of course, exclusive, as the merchandiser doesn't want anyone else selling stuff with your name on it. The usual restriction says you can't sell your merchandise within 2 miles of a concert site, within 48 hours prior to the show. Be sure you exclude retail sales from this restriction. Otherwise, you'll be in breach of both your concert merch agreement and your retail sales agreements. You should also exclude any record company promotions, such as t-shirt or poster giveaways to promote your album, and any merchandise that your record company has the right to make. Refer back to Merchandising Rights in Chapter 13. If you have a tour sponsor or you do a commercial, the sponsor sometimes wants to give away or sell merchandise. For example, they might run a contest where the prize is a special t-shirt that has your picture and their product logo on it. In this situation, you have to specifically deal with this in your merchandising agreement, and your merchandiser isn't going to like it very much. So be extremely careful in giving these rights to a sponsor. The usual compromise is to limit the amount of merchandise the sponsor can give away in a specific city for a number of days before your concert, which is in both your and the merchandiser's interests. If the sponsor gives all your fans a t-shirt just before the show, your concert sales won't be so hot. Creative control. Each of the three merch areas, tour, retail, and D2C, appeals to slightly different fans. And a good merchandiser will guide you to create distinct artwork and products for each outlet. Now, speaking of creating products, you should have the right to approve the design, artwork, photos, drawings, layout, etc. used in all merchandise, as well as the quality of the goods themselves. For the most part, merchandising companies give you creative approval without much of a fight, in stark contrast to the wrestling match you have with your record company over these same issues. If you want to use photos as part of your merchandise, you'll often have to go to the photographer to get the rights. The same might be true of a graphic artist who created unique artwork for your album cover, or who designed a special font, etc. The reason is that, when record companies hire photographers and graphic artists, they pay only for the minimal rights they need to use the material in connection with your records. That means those creators keep all the other rights, which means you don't have the right to put their work on your merchandise. So you have to go to the photographer/graphic artist and say, "How much?" The answer is usually a flat fee that varies with exactly what kind of rights you want, and also the stature of the photographer/graphic artist who created the work. Very rarely, and only for the most superstar of photographers, a photographer might get a royalty. It's essential that you clear the merchandising rights before you use the materials, or else the photographer/graphic artist will have you in a squeezy and demand a seriously huge amount of money. By asking early, if you find out the rights aren't available at a reasonable price, you can use something else. If you have a federally registered service mark for your name, refer back to Chapter 22 for what that is,